Hello and welcome to the Football Diary podcast. Thank you for joining us once again. Unfortunately, Mike's not with us this week, so I'm taking over hosting duties and I'm joined by Dave. Nice to see you, mate. You okay? How are you doing?
Yeah, good, thanks. Yeah, a bit of a strange week this week, and you know, with everything that's gone on since we last spoke.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's worth mentioning that to start with. Now, we obviously we're not politicians, we're not professional journalists, we're friends who love to talk about football. And of course, that's what we will focus on today. It does, however, almost feel futile when the world is going under so much right now and going through so much. And there are so many problems that we could focus on, but particularly the conflict between Russia and Ukraine has obviously dominated the news and most people's thoughts as well. And now, it is devastating to see how people are being treated and how wrong it is to see what people are going through right now. And we obviously send out our thoughts to everyone involved and hope for the most peaceful resolution possible. We will look at how football has responded to this conflict in the show today. There's been widespread issues and there's been responses from various different departments and governing bodies within football as well that we will focus on. But of course, we want to maintain our view of football and how football can help people to come together in these sort of times, how football can be a good way of people still getting some sort of comfort. I think we've seen some really touching things within football as well as the problems. So we will focus on the game itself, but I think worth us maybe having a conversation about it later on, Dave. On the football side, it's not often that we will start with a game that finished 0-0, but when it was such an eventful one, we're going to talk first of all about the Carabao Cup final. Liverpool picking up their first domestic cup under Jurgen Klopp, his first trophy win at Wembley, of course, after beating Chelsea 11-10 on penalties, a big old scoreline after a 0-0 game as well. I think we'll both agree, Dave, that it actually, as far as 0-0s go, it was a pretty brilliant game. And I think two sides that played incredibly well against each other, really, as well. What were your initial thoughts on the 90 minutes? Which side do you think probably deserved the win? And how did you think the whole thing unfolded?
Oh, it was breathtaking to watch, you know, as a neutral. And I'm sure even the supporters will admit that both teams played really well. Arguably, either side could have won it, and both teams had a lot of chances. It's one of those games where the front men weren't quite... I mean, obviously, Chelsea had, was it 3 or 4 goals disallowed? So I think they were a little bit unlucky in a couple of instances. The Lukaku goal in particular was so tight. You know, it was a toenail offside. Again, there was a lot of people have been looking at that and thinking, is it just a little bit too, you know, too harsh, too controversial to call those sort of decisions? But again, a decision's got to be made, and obviously VAR has looked at it and made that decision. But I just feel as though Chelsea had a lot of opportunities, especially in that first half, and they did live to regret. And Mason Mount in particular had 2 golden opportunities, which you probably should have argued you should have taken at least one of those opportunities. And
yeah, definitely.
I'm not too sure, just because of the injury that he came back from, I'm not sure if he's quite at the races yet, and he's sort of looking to get back to that sharpness that we've seen him, particularly last season. He was, you know, unplayable towards the end and had a big impact in them winning the Champions League. And I think that was the story of it, really. There was a lot of the main players. I think Salah had a couple of opportunities where he just couldn't take the opportunities. And, you know, it all came down to that penalty shootout. And for me, it was almost a little bit deja vu, even though United went into it. It felt a lot like the Villarreal shootout in the Europa League final last year, and it ended the same way. The goalkeeper came to take the penalty and missed the penalty. And you know, it had a little bit of a fate feel to it when Kepa came to be substituted on, even though obviously they made that decision in the Super Cup final, and obviously it paid dividends. But Mendy had such a good game. He made some unbelievable saves. you yeah. almost felt as though it was his moment, really. It's easy saying that now, seeing hindsight, but he played so well, and he's an unbelievable goalkeeper. I truly think he's one of the best goalkeepers in the world. And I feel it will probably feel a little bit down coming off and thinking what could have been, but it was such a spectacle to watch, and you can't often say that about a 0-0.
I think it shows how much of a spectacle it is, because there's so many talking points that I want to cover with you, and you've covered a few of them there yourself, but let's just make note of the fact that 4 minutes and 40 seconds into a podcast where we're focusing on Chelsea, Liverpool in a cup final, you managed to moan about United, so good job. Okay, let's look at the first half in particular then, because I thought that was really interesting. I agree, I think Chelsea had the best of it, other than a very big chance for Sadio Mane, who produced an absolutely stunning double save from Edouard Mendy, who, like you say, I think had a fantastic game. Both keepers did, to be fair. Kelleher, who stepped in for Liverpool, has done really, really well there as well. So I think that was an interesting way of viewing the game, whether maybe the keepers were the most influential figures. And of course, one of them became the most influential of all at the end. But in the first half then, Dave, what did you see from Chelsea's setup, and how do you think they tried to deal with the attacking threat that Liverpool clearly possessed? Because Mo Salah was very quiet in the first half. I want to focus on Luis Diaz at some point, because I think he was outstanding. But Chelsea defended well, didn't they? What was their setup like in the first half, and how do you think they planned to deal with Liverpool?
I think when you kind of look at Liverpool normally, they'll traditionally like to get their fullbacks high up the pitch. And I felt as though Chelsea had an influence in the game where they had a foothold in midfield, which kind of didn't allow Liverpool to get as high up the pitch as they would have liked, because Chelsea looked a threat on the break all game. And I think Liverpool were wary of that, and we saw it in moments in the chances that Chelsea did have. It often came from, you know, in certain areas where they found those gaps that Liverpool left, particularly in the wide areas and in the pockets, and they were able to take advantage of that. And I feel as though it did change, especially towards the end of the second half. It seemed like Liverpool were in the ascendancy and looked the more likely team to go on and potentially win it if a team was going to. But particularly in that first half, they did struggle, especially with that intensity that Chelsea had. And arguably should have been one or two up in that first half, even though Liverpool did have a couple of good chances in themselves. But yeah, you've got to give a credit to one thing I will say actually about Chelsea, N'Golo Kante, that was probably one of the worst games I've seen him out of in a big game. I didn't feel as though he sort of stamped his authority as he normally does. He was a little bit careless, sort of in possession and moving the ball forward quicker than he did. But, I mean, in your opinion, what do you think about the way they sort of operated in that first half? Do you think it was it sort of what you expected from Chelsea? And did you feel like Liverpool probably, you know, was it down to Chelsea performing better rather than Liverpool, you know, not quite?
I think Chelsea muted Liverpool. I think they did a really professional job, to be honest. And although I agree about Kante, I think Kovacic's performance, particularly in that first half, was so strong. He dominated that midfield.
He played so well this season, Kovacic. Yeah,
he's fantastic. I think they missed Jorginho, personally. I think I'm only saying that because Kante had enough day, and if he had played to his full capability, then that's not even an issue. And I think Havertz... I love Kai Havertz. I think he's a really good footballer. He's not a number nine, though. He needs to be playing behind a striker. So he cut a quite an isolated figure at times up front. He just doesn't have the touch of pace that he maybe needs at times. And he got caught quite comfortably. And Pulisic as well. I love Pulisic. I think he can be so dynamic. But he wasn't at his clinical best either. And he had that chance in the first half where he hit it straight at Kelleher. And really, Chelsea should have been 1-0 up there. But Liverpool just didn't offer enough, really, for large parts. There was a period, probably 20 minutes in, where they really got their foot on the ball and started to play a bit more football. And Chelsea just defended so well, I thought. Thiago Silva, I thought, was outstanding again. I thought Trevor Chalobah had a really, really good game as well, which was nice to see from a young player as well. But I think both teams were just trying to work out the other one rather than play their own game quite often. And that, I think that's what made it so exciting to see, because you didn't really know what to expect from either of them. Now, obviously, in the second half in particular, there were some big moments and there were the disallowed goals that we can talk about, particularly maybe Joel Matip's and Lukaku's in extra time as well. And I think the other one that I wanted to touch on was Naby Keita. Thiago Alcantara obviously goes off injured in the warm-up, and he was devastated by it because although he's a player with an illustrious career already, he has had a lot of injuries. And although he's playing well for Liverpool, he's yet to really make his mark on a big occasion for the club. So this would have been his opportunity, I think. So he obviously was devastated to come off. And in his place came Naby Keita, another player trying to really stake his claim in that Liverpool team. I think he looked reckless, to be honest.
I thought it was a red card, and the fact that it didn't even get a yellow was
bizarre. Mad. So there were two. In the first half, he catches, I can't think who it was, breaking away in the face with a flailing arm. Looked very reckless. And then in the second half, the challenge on Chalobah, to me, it's not even a VAR review. The ref should spot it. Chalobah tweeted about it afterwards, saying that he required stitches and he cannot understand why the ref didn't do anything about it because he was stood right there. His foot is so high, he doesn't get the ball. He's clearly not in control of what he does. Why was that not a red card, Dave?
I mean, again, it brings a spotlight onto the referees and the VAR system that we hate to talk about, but we find ourselves speaking about so often because of it not being used right, or decisions not being made that should be. And it's just frankly mind-boggling, really, in some of the ways that it's been used, or the lack of its use in these particular moments in the game, which are, you know, the game's on a knife edge, and you have to say, if Liverpool go a man down, then that's a big moment in the game. And
100%.
I believe it should have happened, whether it was a straight red in that decision, or, for instance, obviously in the particular moments that you mentioned there, it could have easily been two yellows, if not a straight red, in three or four moments in that game. And they, you know, lucky for Liverpool, they all went their way. And
Those decisions definitely went their way. I think some Liverpool fans will be incredibly disappointed about the Matip goal in particular. So from what I can see, Van Dijk is given as offside for interfering in play. Is it Van Dijk, I think? That was a difficult one, wasn't it? What do you think of that? Was he involved in play there? Has he done enough to warrant that goal being given offside?
He's had obviously an impact on the goal in that he's block. Oh, whether you think it's a foul or not, I don't think that's a foul. But he had an impact on that particular phase in play, and that he's blocked off the defender and stopped him from getting into position to clear the ball. And we saw it a couple of weeks ago. Pretty much exactly the same goal. Harry Maguire blocking off a defender, and Varane goes and scores that header, it gets ruled out for offside, or I think it might have been a foul. But it's virtually exactly the same goal, and the decision, you know, it was the same decision there. So, I mean, at least they've kind of got a bit of consistency there, and we can kind of praise them for making the right decision there. I think it was the right decision. I don't think it was a foul, but I do believe he had an impact on that particular phase of play.
Yeah. And the other big decision wasn't one for the referee to make. Instead, it was one for Tuchel to make. And he decided to bring on Kepa for the penalty shootout. Now, this is a debate that will go on for as long as football does, really, when it comes to penalty shootouts. We saw in last summer how England made their substitutions set for a penalty shootout with their outfield players. We've seen teams bring on goalkeepers who are penalty specialists before. Kepa comes on. Kepa has a very interesting history with penalty shootouts in the Carabao Cup, as we know. He refused to come off in the 2019 final when Maurizio Sarri tried to bring him off in that game. He's obviously come on in the Super Cup and done well in that penalty shootout. I think he saved four penalties this season. But then he comes on, fails to save any of 11 Liverpool penalties, a couple of which were very savable, and then places his over the bar as well. What do you make of the decision to bring Kepa on then? Because, yeah, I mean, you mentioned already, Edouard Mendy is a fantastic goalkeeper. Not only has he had a brilliant game in this game, I think he was man of the match even without the win, to be honest. He's also someone who's had a great year personally. Moved to Chelsea, which was a huge move for him. Let's remember, he's come from literally nowhere, it feels like, in footballing terms. He's won the African Cup of Nations. He's won the Champions League. He's cemented himself as one of the best keepers in the world. Here was his chance at winning another trophy. What do you think of the decision to bring Kepa on? Can you understand it?
I mean, you know, you've taken me back there, actually, to the moment where, obviously, Sarri was in charge and he refused to come off. I completely forgot about that. And obviously, they went on and obviously lost that shootout. And it was as a moment, you know, everyone was saying he shouldn't be playing for the club after that moment. It got played down and brushed under the carpet. And here we are today talking about another shootout. And like you say, it's a mixed bag of results, really, in terms of Kepa's success against the penalties. Like you say, he's saved four this season. But I mean, for me, Mendy performed so well in that game, and he's got a feel for the game already. He's been playing, you know, and they've brought Kepa on, who's probably barely had a warm-up with, 4 minutes to go at the end. He's come straight into a shootout with so much riding on it.
Yeah.
And, I mean, you can say in hindsight, it's the manager's decision on this occasion. It could have been wrong. We don't know that. But for me, I feel as though Mendy should have stayed on the field. And
yeah,
it's his presence as well, Mendy in goal. He's huge. His reach as well. It must be so daunting stepping up as a penalty taker when you've got goalkeepers with that sort of presence in goal. I just feel as though Kepa is a lot smaller in stature as well. So, I mean, we know his reputation as a goalkeeper, Kepa. He's, you know, he's certainly had his critics over the years since coming to Chelsea with such a huge price tag as well. I feel as though players would prefer to face Kepa than they would see a Mendy in goal. I know I certainly would.
I think it's such a difficult one with these two, because actually, you're right when you talk about Kepa and his reputation within Chelsea. He'd done a lot to repair that this year, though, it felt like. Because being Mendy's understudy, the pressure was kind of off him. And when Mendy was at AFCON, Kepa came in, did well. He's got a good penalty record this year. And it looked like he was starting to carry some favour again. And now he's become the calamity again. And I feel for him on an individual basis, because I don't think it can be easy to deal with the pressure that he's going to face from this. But for me, like you say, that game was so intense in so many ways that coming into it, it was always going to be hard to pick up the intensity that everyone else was at, pick up the level that everyone was at. And Mendy had been performing so well, I would have banked on him a lot more, particularly when you look that Liverpool had their reserve goalkeeper in. So really, you feel like you should have an advantage in that area. And penalties comes down to such fine margins that, yeah, look at Donnarumma's success from penalties, for example. He's such a big presence and so much of the goal is filled when he's there that it puts players off. And Mendy has a similar thing. He's a lot bigger. And when he's had a game like that, where he's managed to produce the saves that he has, that definitely would have a psychological effect on some of the players. Now, you might argue, and hindsight is a wonderful thing, like you say, that Kepa coming on might have a psychological effect on some of the players, and they think, uh-oh, they're bringing him on because he's good. But he didn't really fill himself with glory. I think particularly about the Van Dijk penalty, where he stood in such an odd space in the goal. He stood over to one side, like he knew Van Dijk was going to go there. And Van Dijk did go there and he got nothing on it still. It looked so poor. And I feel for him, but you invite that pressure on someone as a manager when you make that change. Now, of course, he also brought on Jorginho to take a penalty. And really, it's the same sort of thing. And his was successful. And you don't expect your goalkeeper to have to take a penalty or score, even if he does. But the manner in which he missed was bad, wasn't it? I don't understand. In modern football, when you're used to your goalkeeper playing the ball out from the back, you know that he's got a range of passing ability. If you're the goalkeeper, pick a corner and just try and pass the ball into it. If the other keeper saves it, you can understand. No one's going to judge you. It doesn't look that bad. It's done. When you take a goal kick from the penalty spot, as Kepa seemed to do, it's just, it was poor technique, wasn't it? And I know, obviously, you're criticising a goalkeeper for not taking a good shot, but a professional footballer should be able to hit a target.
I mean, the angle that you see the actual penalty taken, you actually don't realise how far over the bar it was. But I saw a graphic today, you know, where you see, obviously, the ball kind of placements in the goal, and it was at least 2 foot,
yeah,
3 foot maybe, even over the bar. And how is that even possible, just from that close a range? But you saw it in his technique and how immediately, as soon as he stepped up to take the kick, and if you freeze it, probably where... before he actually strikes the ball, and you just see his body position, how he's leaning back, there's only one place it's going to go. It's either going to go get skied over the bar, or it's going to get put, you know, right into the roof of the net. But it looked terrible. So I honestly don't know what he was thinking for that. And he probably wasn't thinking. It was purely adrenaline and instinct to strike it in that way. But like you mentioned there, Kelleher didn't get close to any of Chelsea's penalties. Chelsea were very good with their penalties. Kepa got to very close. He got his hand on one of Liverpool's penalties, probably should have saved it with a stronger wrist. But he just, you know, he flapped at it a little bit, and the power just went into the net. But he definitely should have saved at least one. And that's the beauty of penalties, I suppose. And it went Liverpool's way in the end.
And they'll be delighted. And obviously that could have massive ramifications for the whole season. Pep Guardiola always talks about how the League Cup being the first trophy of the season can really give you a momentum builder, give you some confidence. And looking at the run-in that Liverpool have for the league title now as well, they're 6 points behind Man City with a game in hand, and they still have to play City. They have a better goal difference. Really, it's in their hands if they want to go on for it. So, well done to Liverpool on the domestic cup win, and Chelsea really find themselves in an odd situation. And we'll come now to, obviously, the biggest talking point of our week, really, and how the Russian conflict with Ukraine has impacted football. And we'll start with Chelsea as we're there. So, I just want to read a couple of things about what's happened around this, and then we'll talk about the impact that that's really had. As far as Chelsea are concerned, of course, we know their owner, Roman Abramovich, is a Russian oligarch and has ties with certain people in Russia. So it was said this week by a Labour MP. He told Parliament that Roman Abramovich was identified by the Home Office as having links to the Russian state, as well as to corrupt activity and practices. Since then, he has handed over the care of Chelsea to the trustees. His statement read, "I have always taken decisions with the club's best interest at heart. I remain committed to these values. That is why I'm looking up, why I'm today giving trustees of Chelsea's charitable foundation the stewardship and care of Chelsea FC. I believe that currently they are in the best position to look after the interests of the club, players, staff, and fans." Chelsea then released their own statement, which simply said, "The situation in Ukraine is horrific and devastating. Chelsea FC's thoughts are with everyone in Ukraine. Everyone at the club is praying for peace." That was their statement. So, there's a lot to unpick within that. And it's dangerous to unpick some of it, but there are a few things I want to focus on. First of all, Roman Abramovich has handed over stewardship and care, not ownership. It's worth noting. Not ownership, but stewardship and care, which essentially means absolutely nothing. He still owns Chelsea. There is obviously threat that his assets will be seized. And what could that mean for Chelsea as a football club, who I think have borrowed £2 billion from Roman Abramovich? So could really be difficult for them as a club. Of course, they are a UK-based company, but they are an asset of this Russian businessman. It's such an odd statement. And from Chelsea as well, they don't mention Russia at all in the statement. They don't mention the invasion. They don't condone any of the action. But how can they, when they are in the pocket of one of the biggest figures in the Russian economy and someone who has such big links with Russia? So it's awkward, isn't it, for a football club to be a political leader and have to take stances against these things. But Chelsea are kind of find themselves in that position because of their ownership, as could Manchester City with their links to Abu Dhabi, with as could Newcastle, as could many clubs now. But how have you viewed Chelsea's response to this, Dave? And how do you feel about the fans and the managers and the players and the staff at Chelsea and how they now have to deal with this?
Yeah, as you say there, you know, it's a disappointing statement. It's a robotic statement.
There's no
empathy in that statement. There's no compassion, and it's a real lack of recognition of, you know, the situation that Ukrainians are in and how they're being treated in this situation. And it's already been mentioned, obviously it got a lot of attention, that statement, and Jamie Carragher and Gary Neville spoke about it on before the Chelsea Liverpool game and how ridiculous it was. And it's just one of those things, it can be avoided, and it's easy saying this now, it's out in the open, it's been done. And the thing is as well, we talk about this stewardship and, you know, these trustees that have been put in control of the club, well, you know, looking to kind of steady the ship, so to speak. There's rumours that have come out today, and that the trustees, they're looking potentially to resign because of the deep mess that the club is in. It must be just so troubling. And can you imagine being put in that situation where you've got the club basically in your control, and you've no real sort of experience in running the club, and the kind of, is there communication there still with Abramovich? You know, is he still speaking to is the situation? Because
apparently Petr Cech and I've forgotten the name. What's her name? Marina, you know what I'm talking about. Well,
yeah.
They've taken control of the club on a day-to-day basis, and they will have all the final say on everything, and the trustees will be there to give their verdict, supposedly. But I think that's one of the biggest problems. It's so vague. It's so non-specific. It's not really a position of power. It's not really a position of ownership or control of the club. And it is essentially, let me just stay out of the limelight for a little while, because there's going to be a lot explored into Abramovich in particular. And we've known for a long time that this was coming. There's been issues with his ownership in the past. He's someone that's not even been allowed in the country.
I mean, there's been denials, obviously, by Putin. Abramovich and obviously his people have put out that, you know, he's not involved in politics. So, you know, there's no sort of ties there with Putin. But then obviously it's come out in the media today by, you know, reputable sources that Abramovich is almost being a supporter in mediation talks between the Ukraine and in Russia. So that is contradicting in itself. He clearly does have a connection with politics in the country. And again, it's like you say, it's a real mess, and the vagueness of it all really is disturbing. I can imagine Chelsea fans are quite concerned about the situation, as well as obviously football fans.
Once again, it falls on people like Thomas Tuchel and Emma Hayes to deal with these situations in the press. And it's difficult because obviously they are employed by this person and they are happy to take that job and the money that comes with it. So maybe that's something that they need to process and deal with. But of course, they are not experts on these sort of things and will speak as eloquently as they can. And by all accounts, are both very, very good people. Emma Hayes in particular has got a lot of praise recently for the way that she conducts herself. So it's no criticism of her for being employed by Chelsea necessarily. But it's a difficult situation to find yourself in, of course. But right now, it's really important that people do make a stand and fight this injustice. And having such close ties between these issues and football is really dangerous. And of course, Chelsea aren't the only one. I'm just going to read off a list of the way that football has dealt with the Russian conflict so far. I'm reading it purely because I want to get it as accurate as possible. I will say as well that over on The Athletic, they have a wonderful article that is following all the live updates of how Russia and Ukraine has impacted football, how different places in football are responding. So if you want to keep up to date with that and follow more, I would recommend that. But here are the things that we definitely know so far, some of the key events that we've seen. So the Champions League final was obviously due to be held in St. Petersburg. That has been removed. It will not be played in Russia. World Cup qualification matches that were due to be held in Russia are now under threat as well. There was talk that matches will not be held there. Labour MP obviously told Parliament about Roman Abramovich's involvement in the situation, and that obviously prompted Chelsea's reaction too. Poland came out and said that they will not play Russia in their World Cup qualifier. They were then followed, of course, by Sweden and the Czech Republic, saying that they would not play against them or in the country, along with the English FA saying that they will not play any games against Russia in the meantime too. FIFA have said that Russia will not be able to play at home and the team must compete under the name Football Union of Russia. There will be no flags or anthems allowed. I shouldn't laugh, but it is laughable, and we'll come to that in a second, I'm sure. Tributes, of course, and support for Ukraine was shown across grounds, across the world in football this weekend. And specific players, of course, received a lot of support. We'll talk about some examples of that as well. There have been sponsors removed from competitions and clubs, including Gazprom, which obviously is a huge sponsorship deal. And UEFA are planning to remove Spartak Moscow from this season's Europa League. A lot to digest there, Dave. And the impact is obviously felt throughout football as well. Of course, as we've already mentioned, that's secondary to what the people of Ukraine and anyone involved is going through right now. But in terms of how football is dealing with this as a whole, how do you as a fan of football feel? What do you think about some of the sanctions that are being put in place within football?
Well, with the exception of FIFA, I think largely the reaction and the response by football as a whole, clubs, players, has been brilliant. And the real show of unity between clubs and players, and I mean, obviously, for instance, we've seen before games players, you know, standing together with signs, obviously with shirts, and you know, showing a real obviously sort of awareness of the situation and showing compassion. It's really been emotional to see, to be honest. And as fans, and we can't imagine the situation that people are in Ukraine, and it's, you almost feel sort of helpless in a way, and we want to help in whatever way we can, and not just in sport. People all over the world, other countries have come together, and we're doing what we can for the situation. And like I say there, the what FIFA have come out with there and the statement, that it, like you say, is laughable and ridiculous, to be honest. And
the worst,
I can't see, the thing is, we've seen things like that, this happen in football, where clubs, exactly, you know, federations, bodies have come out and they received absolute, you know, flack, and rightfully so. The criticism they receive is just, and they've kind of gone back within, you know, within 24 hours and changed their minds. And I'm flabbergasted, really, that that's come out and they've allowed that to be the case. And
the sad thing is, genuinely, I'm not that surprised by it. We've seen time and time again the people that control football let us down. And for FIFA, really, their biggest concern is the power that Russia will hold. And if this all does get resolved in some way, shape or form, they don't want to feel like they've alienated such a big force, particularly when they will be planning ahead and where they can get the most revenue from. It's a shocking decision from FIFA. And to try and make it seem like, well, it's not Russia, we'll call it the Football Union of Russia, or whatever they wanted to call it, and we'll ban them from singing the national anthem. Like, that is really what is at stake here. It's just a joke. But like you say, again, it's another case of football making the wrong decision. They'll realize that it's the wrong decision and realize that actually they could lose even more from this kind of decision. And they'll backtrack within 24 hours. There's already talk now that FIFA are talking about kicking Russia out of the World Cup because they realized, oh, we've messed up here. It was just like the Super League when these clubs all went for it until they found out the fans didn't want it. It's just like every club that deals with some sort of crisis, as we've seen over the last few months, the likes of David Goodwin's situation over in Scotland and how they've dealt with that situation and backtracked when there's been backlash on it. And FIFA, what can you say about FIFA? Time and time again, the game that we all love, we all cherish, and we all spend a great deal of our time invested in is controlled by people who could not care less about us. They care about how they can make money. And this has been perfectly demonstrated by the fact that even when other people are coming out and saying, I'm not going to play them, I don't want to be involved in this, I want to separate myself from this as far as possible, FIFA are trying to find loopholes to make sure that they can still look like they are supporting everyone. And that's just what FIFA are. I feel glad that the FA have come out and said that England aren't going to play. I wonder whether they would have been so quick to do that had they actually had the scheduled fixtures. I don't know. It's you lose faith in football sometimes. There are certain things, though, that make you gain that faith again. And I think some of the support that's been shown is fantastic. Anything else you want to add to that, Dave, before we move on?
I don't want to go too much into the sort of obviously politics side of it, but I mean, a lot of the questions a lot of people are asking are, once this, you know, there's talks that there are peace talks ongoing, and whether the sanctions that are in place now, if they are to make some sort of agreement between two countries, will those sanctions disappear? And I don't think they will, to be honest. You know, in the situation that Putin put them in as a country, unfortunately, you can't backtrack and just, you know, and say, oh, all these sanctions that were put against you, you know, we'll get rid of them. And for me, there's got to be a price to pay. And I feel as though football as well has got to acknowledge this. They can't just brush it under the carpet and just, you know, when this is all over and just say, oh, you know, Russia, we'll have you back in the competition. There won't be any sort of punishment for it. And unfortunately, you know, the what's happening in Ukraine isn't a reflection of Russian people's views. You know, a lot of people have seen the protests from people over there, and the reaction is absolutely astounding. How many Russian people are getting arrested for protesting? It's crazy to see. So it's just so unfortunate and upsetting for so many people, and it's having such an effect on everything that goes on in the world in terms of, you know, day-to-day life. Just the fact that we're speaking about it on this podcast, obviously, which we love to talk about football, and it just goes to show what a huge impact it's having.
Well, let's try and think of any small positives that we can take. And I think one was the lovely tributes and support that was shown across football as a whole, across various different countries as well. There was signs of respect and tribute, and none probably more so touching than before the Man City Everton game. Obviously, two very influential Ukrainian players featuring that in Zinchenko and Everton's new left back, Mikhalenko. They had a moment of embrace before the game, and Zinchenko was very clearly moved. And to show that it means something to them gives us a bit of courage, at least, that football as a whole is coming together. That game then, let's go back to the football side of things. That game, obviously, very influential at both ends of the table. Man City fighting to retain their title, Everton fighting to retain their place in the Premier League. And actually, another 0-0 that had its moments. I think Jordan Pickford's performance was outstanding, and Everton had a lot of thanks owed to him at times. But they had their moments in the game too. And of course, there was a very controversial decision at the end, which I'm sure we'll come to. Phil Foden got the winner, which means that Man City remain 6 points ahead of Liverpool. It could have been very different though, Dave. Annoyingly, we have to go back to VAR chat. Rodri.
Unfortunately, not a very good goal to discuss as well. But I suppose we'll start with the contentious decision that was made in terms of what was deemed potentially to be a handball. And we had the old discussion the other week about the t-shirt line, and for me it was a penalty, and I'm so surprised that it wasn't overturned. Well, I don't even know whether I can say I'm surprised anymore, because we're continuously being surprised, unsurprised, at decisions that nothing's a surprise, I suppose, anymore. So, you know, I felt as though Everton probably deserved something in the game. You know, Man City did dominate most proceedings, dominating possession, created, I'll probably say, a lot less than what they usually do. And obviously it came to a goal that was ugly, and Phil Foden was in the right place at the right time to take advantage.
Yes. It was such a funny decision. The only thing I can think that the referee that changed their mind, and it's ridiculous, and it means that VAR has completely let it down, is it didn't really seem like there was any need for Rodri to handball it. No. He wasn't under any pressure from an Everton player. It looked like he was just going to chest the ball down, and obviously he misjudged the bounce. And I think the fact that it was under no pressure and didn't really seem like it wasn't him competing for the ball.
There was no one around him to take advantage of that anyway. You know, like you say there, it could have been an impact on referee's decision there.
That doesn't mean that it was the right decision. He still handballed it. I'm just trying to understand why the ref didn't give it, to be honest. The other thing that I noticed is, I think Man City thought it was going to be given, because the ball doesn't go out of play and they all just kind of stop and look around. They were all like, yeah, we'll see what happens here then. But it was bizarre. And I think for Everton, every point counts at the moment. When the likes of Newcastle are picking up points, we'll come to a couple of the other teams in the conversation for relegation in a second, are looking like they might pick up as well. Everton are in real trouble. We've talked about them a few times on this podcast and whether they will just kind of get out of it because they're Everton and they're a big enough club, but it's not looking good, is it? This was a big decision for all of Merseyside, really, but Everton in particular, are you worried for them at the moment?
I was quite surprised in their performance and how well-drilled, well-structured they look. They looked like they were obviously fighting for their manager, and obviously that's the very minimum you'd expect. But they did look, you know, the resistance that they showed against that Man City attack and Man City team on a whole, they actually impressed me. And because I came into this game thinking, you know, Man City are going to win this easily 3-4-0. And he cruised to victory, and it just became one of those games where Man City did just enough with a bit of luck. And you've got to give a lot of credit, especially to I think Frank Lampard in some of the decisions. And you even obviously had Dele Alli, obviously was in the team, and he put a shift in as well. And we've seen that he's had moments in his career where he's not been able to show that discipline, and obviously, you know, wasn't in favour with Conte. And if Lampard can get some of those players to play like that for the rest of the season for him, even though they did struggle to create, but let's be honest, a lot of teams do against Man City with how little of the ball they do have. I don't think they'll get relegated. I think there's worse teams in the league than them. Leeds have got bigger worries than Everton at the moment.
Definitely. Well,
even from the position.
We'll definitely come to Leeds in a second, because obviously that's the other big news. But let's just quickly look at the Premier League table. So on bottom, you have Norwich with 17 points, then Watford with 19, Burnley with 21, Everton 22, Leeds 23, Brentford 24, Newcastle 25. Now, obviously, there is some disparity with how many games those teams have played, but that relegation race is wide open now, isn't it? When you're talking that between Burnley and Newcastle, there's 4 points and five teams. Really interesting picture all of a sudden.
Now, we weren't really talking a few weeks ago about a few teams, obviously, Brentford being one of them. We thought, you know, they'll just have enough, but they've gone on a really poor run of late.
And Newcastle picking up points against them is a really big deal, isn't it? To be honest, I read Newcastle in that list of teams in the conversation, but I think they're probably out of it already, to be honest. They're 4 points clear of relegation now. They look on good form. They're picking up points where they need to. So it's probably three from Brentford, Leeds, Everton, Burnley, Watford and Norwich. You assume that Norwich will take one of the spaces, probably Watford the other one. So then there's one from those, and it's going to be interesting. One team hoping to fight their way out of it, of course, are Leeds, who suffered a 4-0 loss to Tottenham. And that was the end of Marcelo Bielsa. And I think, actually, most people would be quite sad about that. Marcelo Bielsa obviously came into Leeds in the Championship and has had a huge impact on the club and on the city and the fans, really. He really endeared himself to the fans, didn't he? And his way isn't always orthodox. It isn't the most conventional style at times. It can be very aggressive type of football, but it's been entertaining, certainly. But this result brought the whole thing to an end, and you can understand why. They've conceded 20 goals in February, the most by any team in a single calendar month in Premier League history, which is really, really worrying as a start. They're on a downward trajectory. And of course, they are missing some key players, still without Patrick Bamford, still without Calvin Phillips. They've got a small squad, but Spurs themselves weren't in great form coming into this. And there was questions over Conte as Spurs manager already, which seems mad. So Dave, Leeds, what's next for them? And how do you feel about Marcelo Bielsa's exit?
Yeah, you know, he's been there at the club for a while now, and it's going to be strange to not see him on the touchline in his usual squatting, crouch down position. I don't know how his knees are, because mine would be my knees are terrible. But
I just thought what's going to happen to the bucket. I feel really bad. And also his little translator. I loved him. He was great.
Yeah, he's obviously a huge figure at Leeds, and they won't forget obviously what everything that he's done for them. And just how exciting they have been to watch. And I wouldn't say as much this season. They've definitely lacked a lot more in terms of going forward, especially in the last few games. You know, they've kind of dropped down the table, and there's been, like you say, a big concern over the numbers in their squad. And they've obviously definitely missed Patrick Bamford up the top end of the field. They've struggled to score goals in the last few games. Jack Harrison hasn't looked the player that he was looking earlier in the season. So a lot has gone wrong for them in such a short space of time, and it's crept up on them, really, those relegation spaces. And I'm sure Leeds fans will be just kind of wondering how they managed to get into this position.
The problem is that how are they going to get out of it now? Because I watched this game and I've seen Leeds a couple of times recently. I obviously watched them play Villa and they got a draw there somehow. But defensively, they are so open. And although they've got some very talented players on the pitch in the likes of Rafinha, I think Rodrigo is a very good player as well. When Calvin Phillips comes back, we know what he's capable of. But defensively, they just look so weak and they just leave so much space to be attacked. Now, they are definitely in this relegation battle now. And by the time this podcast comes out, they'll have probably done something completely different and I'll look stupid and Sam Allardyce will be manager or something. But it looks almost certain that they're bringing in former RB Salzburg and Leipzig manager Jesse March to come in for the rest of the season at least. Now, March was appointed to be Nagelsmann's replacement at Leipzig. It didn't last very long. He left in December. No experience of the Premier League. I'm not sure whether he's really ever had a relegation battle to contend with. But that looks like where Leeds are going with this. What do you make of that appointment? Is there enough in his managerial history and the fact that he's worked with such good players like Haaland at Salzburg and developed some really good talents there like Minamino? Have you seen enough of Jesse March to think that it's a good appointment for Leeds? Or is it maybe a good appointment at the wrong time? What do you think of this one?
Yeah, you might be right about that. It might be, you know, the right appointment at the wrong time in terms of how, you know, with what is it, 11, 12 games we've got left of the season now?
Yeah.
It could come to if they were to get relegated and be in charge of the club, would that be a long-term appointment? Probably not. So it's a risk, I would say. Jesse March, like you say, he's got a great reputation in terms of what he's done in some of the clubs in RB, particularly at Salzburg. He did have a really good reputation. For whatever reason, it didn't quite work out at Leipzig, but I can imagine Leeds will have done their homework on particular candidates, particularly what would work with the style of play. They definitely need to be more organised in their style of play. There needs to be a plan B, because they just seem to be stick to type. They aren't able to revert to type because they don't know anything other than, you know, plan A. So he definitely does need to bring something different. They need to be able to be more difficult to beat, like you say there, particularly the last few games. It's just, they look too easy to play against. Teams create so many opportunities and chances against them. So it becomes more of a case of that Leeds have to score two or three goals themselves to even be in the shout with being competitive in the game. And we've seen that, particularly over the last four games. Obviously, they drew, was it 3-3 with Villa? They obviously scored two against United. It wasn't enough. They conceded four. They lost 6-0 to Liverpool. Obviously, lost 4-0 to Tottenham against the bigger teams. They aren't being difficult enough to beat. And that is something that you need to be in the Premier League. As good as you are going forward, you need to have that balance, and it's just something that they don't have.
Well, we'll see how Leeds get on for the rest of the season. Worth mentioning in this game, of course, Spurs as well, who I can't work Tottenham out under Antonio Conte, really, because they've been on this weird run of form where they've lost 4 in 5 but beat Man City in the middle of that. Came into this game after a loss to Burnley, where Conte sort of intimated that he thought he was done. His comments after the Burnley game were so strange, and it really sounded like he was ready to walk away from it, and he just didn't think he was the right man for this club. He then came out and kind of retracted all of those comments, and they went in, put in a great performance against Leeds, particularly the first half. Thought they looked electric going forward. The fullbacks got high. They found the space. That's what they really needed to do. They looked a lot more organised at the back as well. So it was a good win for Spurs. And again, it just opens up the league table again. Elsewhere, Southampton beat Norwich 2-0, worrying Norwich fans for their potential relegation. Newcastle, as we mentioned, beat Brentford 2-0, a huge result for them, and a second goal in two games for Joe Willock as well. Good to see him back on form. Crystal Palace and Burnley drew 1-1, another valuable point for Sean Dyche's men. Man United drew 0-0 with Watford. Less glamorous. I mean, they still sit in the top four somehow, but it's... do you know what? We're not going to talk about United for long. I just want to say, I actually thought United played quite well at times in this game. They created a lot of chances, and had Bruno Fernandes in particular been a bit more clinical, this would have been a very different story. I thought Ronaldo looked really good in his build-up play, but not necessarily in his shot-taking. So it was a funny result for them. Aston Villa got back to winning ways, 2-0 win against Brighton, which was nice to see. Ollie Watkins getting his first goal in 7 games, which I think is really important for him. And that was our Premier League this weekend. So it's an interesting table, isn't it, Dave? Who knows? Oh, and of course, West Ham. West Ham beat Wolves 1-0. Big result there in terms of the top four.
So, very good result for West Ham, that. Particularly how well Wolves have been performing.
Yeah, shame for Wolves. Obviously, they've lost the two games against Arsenal and lost to West Ham. So in terms of their competing at the top end, they're probably not going to quite make the cut. But it's such an interesting table, isn't it, Dave? And of course, Arsenal didn't play this weekend, so who knows who the top four is going to be? Who knows who the bottom three is going to be?
Some big games coming up in the coming weeks, particularly.
Yeah, definitely. And some big deciding fixtures at both ends that we can really look forward to. I can't wait for the Man City-Liverpool game, to be honest. I think that's going to be a really interesting one.
Manchester Derby as well. That could be pivotal. I think we've got to play Liverpool soon as well. So, you know, not just defining top four, but
yeah,
these are fixtures that could define, you know, the title. So
definitely, and Arsenal, of course, pushing for the top four. I've got 3 games in hand that happen to be against Chelsea, Liverpool, and Spurs. So it's not easy, is it? It's going to be it's genuinely turning out to be a really fascinating season, which I'm really glad of. But that's all we've really got time for today, I think. Once again, it's just worth touching on the main topic, and just let us know that everyone from the Football Diaries is thinking about anyone that might be suffering right now or going through any of the terrible things that are happening across Europe and particularly in Ukraine. Our thoughts go out to anyone involved there. Thank you, Dave, for talking not just on the football, but on those matters so eloquently as well. I really appreciate that, mate. It's good to have serious chat with you as well. And hopefully next time we talk, there's a bit more resolution to those issues and we can focus purely on the football. But until then, thanks for joining me today, Dave.
Thank you very much. Enjoyed it.
Thank you, everyone that's watched as well. Of course, you can follow us on our socials that you can see at the top of the screen. We are on YouTube. We are on Spotify. So please, 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 as we are trying to develop our channel, give us a like, give us a follow, give us a subscribe. Tell your friends, tell your brother, tell your mother, tell your sister, tell everyone we're out here. And hopefully we can continue to produce some content for you guys. So once again, thank you for joining us on the Football Diary podcast. Until next week, see you guys later.